And a very good middle of the week hello. Good afternoon. Isn't sunny and beautiful like I'd kind of hoped it would be for this, the 29th of April, but it's not too shabby. It's not bad. Here we are, ready to go in this middle of the week. Some people call it hump day. Do we still have the camel on the payroll? I'm so happy to hear that. All right. We've got our relentless positive radio, and you can stream us, podcast us, come back if you can't be here right now, noon to 2. Of course, if you're not here right now, you're not hearing me say this, but I'm saying it anyway. Also, I hope you have the free WJR app, a great thing to have on your phone and have with you at all times. Right now, Facebook and YouTube pages are, in fact, streaming our show live. More and more people are starting to watch it and following your daily dose of Dietz. Having a good time with that, and, of course, Old Talk with Kevin Dietz. And then JR Afternoon, the man of the hour, Ryan Ermani, is going to have lots to share with us about his foray to the Capitol and the historic address by King Charles III.
And, Paul, have you been following Ryan on Facebook throughout this whole thing? Well, you don't do
Facebook.
Why
would you ask me that question?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, because I want to bring up Ryan's Facebook post.
All right, so just bring it up.
There's a picture of, you know, the chamber of where Congress meets.
Right.
And way, way, way in the back, there's like a little speck, and there's like a an arrow pointing at it. He goes, "Look, that's me," and you can't see him. It's really funny.
Well, he was in the, what do they call that area? I can't remember. But be that as it may, you can't bring something up unless you can show it. Can you show that picture?
You know what? I will show the camera here.
All right.
So.
Okay. Up in the gallery.
Yeah.
Up
and then you see there's that little pointer finger. And the caption says, "That's me."
Oh, that's nice. Hey, that's cool. Yeah. You know what? No one can ever take that away from him. No. He was there for an historic second time only that a monarchy, a member of the monarchy, has been there to speak, and the first king ever. And for our history, just watching it and listening, we haven't seen both sides of the aisle stand for anything in a long time. And he said a lot of things that I'm so glad everybody stood for, because they should have.
And you know
what? He did a fabulous job.
He was funny.
He's got a sense of humor.
I'm usually not a fan of British comedy, but he had jokes and they were pretty good.
He did there were people who were questioning him because his mother did such a good job, but others who know him said, and I mentioned this on the show, that he was going to do great, maybe even better, because he's looser than the Queen was. The Queen, by necessity, was much more formal, much stiffer. He's looser. He smiles, he laughs, he tells jokes, and he did a great job. And God bless him. I mean, he waited all his life to be king. He becomes king and almost immediately gets diagnosed with cancer. So it's a sad situation. On the other hand, he is without question making the most of it. He and Queen Camilla travel to, they might be, I don't know, are they in New York yet? I didn't even look.
I feel like they did arrive this morning. I don't know how long they're staying there, but.
As a young man, he was at the 9/11 area before the memorial was built. So now he's seeing it for the first time, and he's meeting with some families of the 9/11 victims. And then the king, it will be, where else are they going? I can't see it here. I thought there was something more, but they just go on and on about the speech, which, of course, focused mostly on the kinship between the U.S. and the U.K. But his sense of humor was excellent. And it's the 250th anniversary since we broke from his family, and he handled that pretty well. Somebody who's not quite as funny, if he were nearly as talented as, say, Johnny Carson, he'd have 10 times the audience he has, but as we've mentioned, the three top nighttime shows added together don't come to half the audience that Johnny Carson used to get, because Johnny Carson knew he was there to entertain and not take political stands, which is what all these guys are doing now. Now you got the FCC putting pressure on Disney. This is all going to backfire, because the average person is saying, oh, they're just doing that because the president hates Jimmy Kimmel. Well, that is what they're doing, and it's unfortunate because It's the use of a federal agency the way we complained Joe Biden used them. So why do we turn around and use them that same way, we being the people that are in power now, speaking in the third person
right
here?
Well, and, you know, this administration is so good at taking something that they could use to probably get more people on their side, you know, like a joke about the president's death, and then using it to overstep their bounds and then canceling out any goodwill they might have built.
They were on the road to something good, and it goes bad because they keep going. They don't know when to stop or to stop talking. But here's another interesting thought. The more Jimmy Kimmel talks, the more you realize he's a liar who says, I never meant any harm by that joke about her being a widow. I was just about their age difference. Well, does anyone remember any conversation about the age difference between Joe Biden and Jill Jacobs? Jill Jacobs was a 24-year-old college student when Joe Biden was a 33-year-old senator when they started dating. That's plenty of material for jokes. Did you ever hear Kimmel tell a joke about that? No, you didn't, and you wouldn't, because he's a liar, and he should just say, look, I'm a spokesperson for the Democrat Party and for the liberal wing of the Democrat Party, and that's what I'm going to do. And I get my $15, $20 million a year from ABC to do that sort of thing. And if ABC's fine with that, then let ABC be fine with it. You know, I have a blessing. I have Xfinity at my home, which I love,
right,
and they're having a fight with ABC, so I can't watch Jimmy Kimmel if I wanted to.
Right. Or the
and nobody else can, and nobody's right. Complaining, apparently. I don't know.
Or the Pistons, mercifully. So it sounds like something that was a negative last week, Paul, you've turned it into a positive.
It's a positive. That's what you have to do.
I guess that's why you're relentlessly positive.
That's relentless positive radio at a negative time. But anyway, you're on your way to making each and every day count, because each day is a gift, and we appreciate that. And Kim would remind us about the QTR, quality time remaining. We have no idea how much QTR we have. I do want to thank you for choosing to be an important part of the best and brightest audience in all of radio. It means a lot to us, that's for sure. And that's the case, not just when you listen noon to two. I wouldn't be so selfish as to pretend that our show is the only one. It's all of our shows on this radio station. And that is a fact. And that goes through the weekend as well. And we've got the team together, the best in radio. Of course, Mike Parsons, our executive producer, Danielle Mason, queen of the switches, running the controls, and Rich Luzinski, who we haven't talked to in a long while, but Rich, of course, is keeping an eye on our WJR traffic and weather first to make sure that we are all set. Speaking of the historic moments and Charles III making his pitch for unity, Tim Walberg is the man of the hour who made it all happen. The Republican congressman from the 5th District will be our first guest. We'll talk about King Charles' address to Congress, his visit there with Ryan Ermani, and his latest newsletter, where he shows he's doing a lot for us here in Michigan. It's Focus with Paul W. Smith on a Wednesday afternoon, April 29th, on WJR. What a pleasure it is to welcome, really, the man of the hour, Congressman Tim Walberg, the Republican from the 5th District. I have in my hand his most recent newsletter, Strengthening Our Workforce. But first, I want to talk about the opportunity that he afforded us at WJR to have Ryan Ermani join him at the Capitol for an historic event. So on behalf of all of us at WJR, thank you for that opportunity.
Well, we certainly appreciate WJR, a blowtorch of a station that you can, I know I can catch all the way to Cleveland as I'm driving back to Washington on occasion. And you can catch it all the way to the west edge of my district. And I know even one time I picked you up in Milwaukee. So it's out there. And as you know, I gave you the first invitation because, as I said to you, Paul W., you probably interviewed the king before he was a king. So it would be pretty cool for you to be there when he gives his first speech before Congress. But it was also historic in that it was the second speech. His mother was the first in 1991.
Right.
And so here he comes as a king and speaks. And I know that you've been traveling and it was difficult to get back in the swing. So while we were disappointed you couldn't make it, I was very delighted with the new kid on the block who's an excited guy and does such a great job, Ryan Armani, for him to be there. And it was fun to, after the speech, and he was bouncing off the walls.
He was like a kid in a candy shop, wasn't he?
It was wonderful. And then to take him a little tour of the Capitol and see the Capitol anew through a guy who had never been there before and was just excited with it. And that's, you know, it's the people's house, and they ought to see it and experience what it really is. Oftentimes we hear all of the negatives about what's going on in Washington, but you don't get a chance, as he did, to meet some of my colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, who I care for a lot, love them like brothers and sisters, and that's all also good to see, that it's not just haranguing each other all the time and being totally opposed to what one side wants because they're the other side. It's not always that way.
We're all looking forward to hearing Ryan at 2 o'clock today talk about the experience and how great it was. History in the making, as I want to find out from you, because this is historic, and it's only happened twice. This is the first time we've had a king giving the speech, and I have to tell you, you know, his mother did a great job. He did as good a job or even better, meaning no disrespect either way, as he made a very strong and lucid pitch for unity. And wouldn't it be fascinating if the guys we broke away from 250 years ago actually helped us come back together with ourselves, which is so important right now with the schism that we have in this country.
I agree, and he didn't shy away from that, even talking about the correspondence dinner that was upset by a crazy guy. Another attempt, assassination attempt on our president and probably on cabinet officials if he'd been able to get through. I'm glad he wasn't. And it'll also be good, the fact that he lived and wasn't killed, so we can maybe get some information on what was going through his mind to bring him to do something like this. But the king didn't shy away from that, but you're right. It was a wonderful speech. It was very lucid, and it was humorous. And he got Democrats and Republicans laughing together and standing up and applauding him on a number of occasions. And the president last night, when he spoke at the state dinner, he referred to that, saying, "Your Highness, you did something I was never able to do, and that's get Democrats to stand and applaud."
That's true. It was beautiful to see, because we don't ever see that. You're right.
Yeah. So, no, it was well done, and he ended strong, and as he in a humble way, self-deprecating way, he referred back to 1776 and the subsequent things that has gone on. He even referred to getting to the White House and not burning it down like the last time.
The last time the Redcoats were on the lawn of the White House, they were burning it down.
So, no, it was good, and I think it was a unifier for that moment. We're back at it again today with some lack of unity on some of the issues, including FISA and Homeland Security funding, and it may be a long night tonight, and I've encouraged the speaker, if necessary, to keep us through the weekend until we get it done. We have to do it for the people. We have to do it for our security. It's the right thing to do. We need to pay the people. They're doing significant jobs for us. They need to know that there's a certainty there, and in the House, we passed that 4 times already, the funding bill. Mm. The FISA bill, we haven't passed yet, though we did rework it several years ago, and in the form that it's in now, it has worked perfectly without any civil rights violations on American citizens. So hopefully we can come together and get those things done.
I pray that that's the case. Congressman Tim Walberg with us, and he's the chairman of the Education and Workforce Committee. He's put forward his A Stronger Workforce for America Act. He is trying to protect our Great Lakes fisheries. You are doing an awful lot, and I just want people to understand. And the other area of very important information is for our Michigan farmers who work from dawn to dusk to put food on our tables. You're worrying about the farmers and you're empowering our hardworking farmers. And you've come up with a couple of ways that are very important, the working families tax cuts and a lot of things that are going to help our farmers.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a farm bill, much of which we put into the One Big Beautiful Bill, Working Families Tax Cut Bill. And so that enables them to have some things that they really need without being encumbered by the political battles that go on over the rest of the farm bill, which is, you know, only 20%, Paul W., you probably know this, 20% is actual agriculture related in the sense of farming operations. 80% is for food security, welfare, food program, SNAP, WIC, et cetera. And that is always where it gets political on how much you're going to put in that and how many government programs you continue. But we have a farm bill that has come out of committee now in a bipartisan fashion, not unanimous, but in a bipartisan fashion nonetheless, that we hope that we can pass even today and let the farmers know that we've completed a job that needs to be done every 5 years, and we've got it done. And I think when we think about a $39 trillion debt, this budget or this farm bill is budget neutral. And that's amazing to say. And so I'm hoping my colleagues have the common sense that God at least attempted to put in them to say, let's not demand our own perfection, but let's move this farm bill forward that will help the people who, as you say, work from dawn to dusk and feed not only the United States, but the world.
And God bless you for that legislation that permanently doubles the death tax exemption, protecting family-owned farms and allowing them to be passed from one generation to the next. That's an extremely important piece of legislation. We thank you for all you continue to do, Congressman Tim Walberg, a Republican from the 5th District, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask for care of the maybe one of unity coming off of this King Charles III and his most incredible visit.
Well, Paul W., you give me that pleasure quite often. So let me say it this way, as I pray to God, that God will enable us, he who is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that his kingship will invade our lives in a bipartisan way to do what we need to do for the people who we serve and who've given us the privilege of this type of service, that we think about them in a way that says, for the common good and for the future of this great country, to build it, not tear it down. And may the King of Kings give us success. And it's in his name I pray. Amen.
Amen. God bless you. Keep up the good work, Congressman, always.
Paul W., thank you. Have a great day.
You do the same, Congressman, the Republican from the 5th District, Tim Walberg, as we continue in focus on WJR. Not often we get to talk to somebody who is running an organization that is celebrating its 110th year anniversary. That's the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. And I bet you a dollar if I asked 10 people what that is, 9 of them may not know. And I'd be included in that as well, not being able to quickly, easily define what the Citizens Research Council of Michigan is all about. But luckily, we have its president, Eric Lufer, who's here now to talk to us. And let me just say, first of all, happy 110-year anniversary.
Well, thank you very much, and it's my pleasure to join you today.
I think some people might be surprised that at the November 3rd, 2026 general election, there will be a proposal to look for, 2026-01, that will ask us as voters whether a constitutional convention should be convened for the purpose of a general revision of the 1963 Michigan Constitution. And furthermore, we're going to be asked that every 16 years.
Right. Yeah, so local government, our state government, has, we sort of put it in the background and don't pay a lot of attention to it. And back in the 60s, when they wrote our current constitution, they said, let's check in with the voters from time to time. Let's just not assume that everything is working great. So let's put a provision in that says, should we stop what we're doing and convene a group to write a new constitution and submit that to the voters and ask if that is better than the current constitution. So it's good that we do that. It's a way of checking in, understanding what's happening. But at the same time, because government sort of happens in the background, we don't suppose a lot of people are really paying close attention to what's working or not working. You come across things that don't seem to be working from time to time, but you don't know why or everything. So the Citizens Research Council, as you said, is a 110-year-old organization, and our mission is just paying attention to things like this, understanding how state and local government work, trying to explain that to the people, and most importantly, to the people we elect to represent us in city, county, state government, school boards, and so on. And we pay attention to things like the Constitution. So we're doing an analysis of how our current Constitution is working and trying to help people understand, not advocating for a yes or a no vote on that question, but just help people to think about how government affects them, tax issues, election issues, the representation in the legislature, our university system, and so on, and think about how we can be better as a state if some of those things need to be addressed.
Yeah, let me, for anybody who's sitting there going, sure, Eric Lufer, President, Citizens Research Council of Michigan, but what's his political bent? What's the real reason? I got to tell you something that's shocking to me. This organization, the Citizens Research Council, takes absolutely no position on the question of calling a constitutional convention or not. That's not what you do.
That's not what we do, or many other issues. We're trying to find out ways that government can be better at doing the things that it does. But we're not elected the kings of Michigan, so we're just trying to get that information into people's hands so they can make better decisions. If you decide it's time to buy a new refrigerator or a new car, you're going to do your research and say, well, which one's the best one and what has the features that I like? We try to do that with government, right? How do tax policies work and how does township government work so that you can make informed decisions on the things that are important to you?
Can you make a gut call for me? Do you have a gut feeling on whether people are upset with enough things in our Constitution that they'll in fact want to do this?
You know, there's two sides of it. On the one hand, we're a very purple state, and there's a lot of distrust of the other people. If you're a Republican, that's a Democrat. If you're the Democrats and it's the Republicans, you're afraid that if they get the majority and write that constitution, that it might be unfavorable to you. But on the other hand, I think a lot of people just look at government, whether that's city government, state government, or federal government, and have a feeling that it could, should, and must be better. And we have a Mayor Duggan running on a platform that our system's broken and only he can fix it. So there's push and pulls of that. I don't really have a strong feeling on how people are going to feel in November, but every day we turn on the news and we're confronted with something that just doesn't seem to be working as well as we would hope it would.
Mm-hmm. A quick question before we let you go, Eric Lufer, president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, 110 years old this year. How are you funded? How do you exist?
Well, we're a 501c3, so we get funding from foundations, businesses, individuals. It's a tax deductible donation. Sometimes we do some funded research, but it's really charitable, and that's why I value being on your show and helping people who don't know about us, those 9 of 10 people, learn about us. Our website is crcmich.org, and we're here to be an asset for everyone.
crcmich.org. crcmich.org. Thanks for coming on board and informing our listeners, because we want to be informed, and for the work you've done for the past 110 years. We appreciate you.
I appreciate the opportunity. Have a great day.
You do the same. Eric Lufer, president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, crcmich.org, will be asked November 3rd, if we think there should be a constitutional convention in Michigan for the general revision of our 1963 Michigan Constitution. Hadn't really given it a thought, but now we all are. As we continue in Focus with Paul W. Smith at WJR at 1244. Well, here we go again, and luckily we have Jared Halpern, who has to dive into this mud. A Fox News correspondent, WJR contributor extraordinaire, you know by now that the former FBI director, James Comey, once again indicted by the Department of Justice. And, well, I'll let you take over here, Jared, and give us your two cents on this. Nice to have you on board, as always. Hope you're having a good Wednesday.
Thank you. Yeah, listen, I think this is something that has gotten a lot of attention because there has been criticism, frankly, from Democrats and Republicans over this indictment, questioning the Justice Department's decision here to pursue criminal charges against James Comey for a social media post, an Instagram post last year that depicted shells on the beach that said 647, this is federal prosecutors say a direct threat to President Trump, that this was a call to violence. Comey has said that he understood it to be a political message, did not see it as political violence, deleted the post. And so now the question is largely going to fall on intent. And that can sometimes be hard to prove. We did hear from the acting attorney general yesterday that this was an investigation that covered many months and will rest on testimony and evidence that has been collected. So I suppose we'll see where this moves forward. The initial court appearance here for the former FBI director is this afternoon in the Eastern District of Virginia. In I think Alexandria is where the courthouse is. And that, I guess, will be our first sense on kind of how a magistrate judge views this and kind of what the next steps look like.
Well, first of all, for James Comey, it was a stupid thing to do. He certainly knows what 86 means. Everybody knows that means get rid of or whatever, 86. And 47, of course, was referring to the 47th president of the United States. Seeing seashells that even if he didn't put him in that position, just stumbling upon it, what in the world would cause him to decide as the FBI director or former that he should draw attention to that and put it on social media? That's just plain stupid. He's smug and he's not likable. But the president is falling into the trap and has been for a while of doing exactly what the Bidens did in the Biden administration that we criticize, and that is using federal agencies being used for personal vendettas. And yeah, right on the heels of James Comey comes the whole FCC reviewing of broadcast licenses of Disney stations because of Jimmy Kimmel's lack of being funny.
You know, and as I said, there is some criticism here from both sides of the aisle. Congressman Tom McClintock is a Republican from California. He is notably a member of the House Judiciary Committee. And he wrote here on social media that James Comey's many lies, abuses of power, and election interference will be judged harshly by history. But DOJ, he says, has jumped the shark by criminally charging him for his juvenile shell message. That speech, it's idiotic and spiteful, but not criminal. So, again, we'll see how this moves forward in the days ahead, but the Justice Department has faced some probing questions about their decision to pursue these charges so long. We're several months away from this post being made and ultimately deleted by James Comey.
It's sad, it's unfortunate, and it's obvious that a lot of the people in this administration work out of fear of the president's wrath. And there's no question, there's no shortage of wrath when the president feels somebody should be gone after. And even worse, when someone goes after them and are not successful in this case, prosecuting, he keeps pushing for them to do it again. And the idea, the same thing with Jimmy Kimmel, who's not successful, who won't be around in a few years because it doesn't work. The late night shows don't work like they used to. You can argue the reasons why they don't, but the bottom line is they're not making the money they used to, nor getting the ratings or leading to a big audience at night so that when people wake up in the morning, they're on that same channel and they help the morning shows. It's hard to justify their existence. But it's very hard to go up against these people and knock the freedom of speech that we have in this country and that we embrace.
That's going to be a big part, I think, of the messaging you hear from Democrats, from critics of the president, that this is kind of doing what they have accused other administrations, the Biden administration, of doing, right, of going after political foes, those whose speech they did not approve of, and trying to weaponize the Justice Department. Again, we heard those questions from the acting attorney general. He says that he's not going to worry about the politics, that they'll move this case forward. And as I said, this afternoon, we'll get our first sense of kind of how swiftly this case against Comey may or may not move forward.
All right. Jared Halpern, Fox News correspondent, WJR contributor. Thank you much. We'll continue on WJR. Here we go. Hour number two of Relentless Positive Radio. A pleasure being with you as you're on your way to making each and every day count. Each day is. And we don't know how much QTR we have, as Kim would point out, quality time remaining, but let's make the best of it. And I do want to thank you for choosing to be an important part of the best and brightest audience in all of radio. That's whenever you tune in to WJR, whether you're streaming us, whether you're listening on the free WJR app, or coming back and podcasting us. That counts, and it's a quick way to listen to a two-hour radio show in about an hour and 10 minutes, all at WJR.com. Right now, Facebook and YouTube pages are live streaming, and we're happy to be here. And getting excited, in the next hour, we're going to hear from Ryan's most incredible special trip to Washington, D.C., to be there for the King Charles historic really pitch for unity for the United States and the United Kingdom. And in fact, right now, King Charles and the Queen are taking part in a 9/11 memorial event in New York City. I do not see. He's probably at a No Kings rally, and it'd be embarrassing to then actually be with a real king. I thought that was funny. No jokes, no laughs, no anything. Come on, where's my audience?
Sorry, we're watching what's going on.
Okay. But it's true. I don't see Mamdani.
No, I don't think.
I think, what's his name? The old, the rich mayor.
I saw Bloomberg there.
Bloomberg is there, and, you know, he's standing next to the king. They're probably old pals. They're both billionaires.
Right.
So, but I have not seen the mayor in what I've been looking at. So anyway, whatever it happens, and we'll keep track of it, of course, on what's going on. The president is saying that Iran has told the U.S. that it wants the Strait of Hormuz open ASAP. I'm not exactly sure what that means or what we're supposed to take away with that.
Yeah, I mean, if Iran wants it reopened, then reopen it. I feel like they've got the decision making.
I thought they were the ones keeping it closed by threat and of the water mines and all kinds of stuff.
Right. So cool. Thanks. Okay. Then reopen it and problem solved.
You go first.
Prices. Yeah. Exactly.
You go first, Iran. You put your boats through there first. Make sure the mines don't blow you up, so they don't blow us up. United Arab Emirates says it's leaving OPEC.
Yeah. I don't know what exactly that means, other than our gas and oil prices will probably be going up even more.
Thought it was a good line. It didn't hit me right away, but I realized the president out there in the, I don't know, is it the Rose Garden, somewhere outside there, when it was raining, and he said, it's a beautiful British day.
Oh, is that why he said it was a beautiful British day?
Yeah, because that's really, they have a lot of rain.
Yeah, it's a beautiful British day right now, cold
and
gray.
Yeah, we're having our own British beautiful day without having to get on a plane or travel at all.
Right, what's the expression, he brought the weather with him?
I guess it might be. He didn't want to bring this weather, I'm sure. Congressman John James, they say now, I've said it a few times actually, that he has the early lead in the GOP race for governor. You know, in all these races, and they talk about the who's the leader in the Republican Party, who's the leader in the Democrat Party, do they also add in there where I think one of the strongest candidates, Mike Duggan, is? Do they just not say it because they're not used to saying it because they're so used to the two-party system?
No, I think what this is, I think these are polls for the primary. And since Duggan is running as an independent, he's not running against anyone else. He's going to be
avoided
on the
primary.
Right.
That was a smart move. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, right now it's just the parties themselves. And also, Paul, we'll talk more about this with Richard Zuba. They did polling for the Senate on the Democrat side, but they didn't do any polling on the Republican side because Mike Rogers is either running unopposed for that nomination or is just so far ahead that they decided not to.
Well, Mike Rogers is a great guy, and we miss him a lot. The president should have made him head of the FBI in his first term, but that's another story. I go backwards. But I go backwards all the time. Anyway, we see that Haley Stevens leads El Sayed in the new Michigan U.S. Senate poll. I guess what you were talking about, the Democrats have released that figure.
Yeah, and it seems like her, Haley Stevens, El Sayed, and Mallory McMorrow, it feels like they take turns being out in front depending on the day and the poll.
I don't quite understand this. Maybe you do. The NCAA expanding March Madness men's and women's college basketball tournaments to 76 teams in 2027. It seems to me as if March Madness will go over about a three-month period
right.
of time.
And also, Paul, I think they'll expand it so much that you and I can start a team and we'll be in the tournament. It's a bit much.
I just think that's a lot. 76 teams.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, can these bubble teams, can they complain now if they didn't, if they're team number 77? Because if you didn't make the top 76, I think if you didn't make the top 64 or whatever, you don't have a right to complain. But now, if you're not one of the best 76 teams in the land, then better luck next year.
We got a couple Tiger injuries. How's that going to affect our game?
Yeah, two all-stars yesterday from last year. Casey Mize, he took himself out with some tightness in his groin. And I guess Javi Baez, he slid into first base on a really weird play. You don't often hear of people sliding into
first.
Yeah, so I don't know the extent of those injuries. But, I mean, the Tigers have been hot. They've been an exciting team. And hopefully we get those guys back and just keep it moving.
That's where the expression next man up
right.
comes into a play on a team. The team, the team, the team. Like we have the team, the team, the team. I don't go on crazy rides. I never was big on it. I mean, I've gone on roller coasters and stuff like that. But every time I read now about, here's a case of Six Flags guests forced to climb down from the Superman roller coaster after the ride stalls at the highest point. Let me give you my two cents on this. We've all seen in all businesses a shortage of people. I'm telling you, I think, I see it in the Secret Service, I see it everywhere, that there are fewer people doing more jobs than ever. Why the heck do I want to get on a roller coaster or some other ride? Oh, that there are actually probably fewer people overseeing the safety of that ride
right.
than ever before.
That's a good point, yeah.
Why would I do that?
I think this ride was like 200 feet high, and I'm not a big roller coaster guy myself, so when I saw that, I'm like, no, thank you.
No, thank you. No, thank you. And I know we're near Cedar Point, and they always fight to have the best and most and fastest and highest and craziest roller coaster. I don't know if they're still in the running or not. We haven't talked to folks from Cedar Point in a long time. So there's this, and you taught me this is called clickbait.
Oh, yes.
I saw a headline, and I didn't have time to go to it, but I had interest because the clickbait said Costco changes $1.50 hot dog for the first time in 40 years or whatever it said. And I was just at Costco, and I had one of their hot dogs. They're so delicious.
Oh, yeah.
You get a hot dog and a pop for $1.50. And so I said, what did they change? And you said...
that now you get a choice between either the fountain drink or a bottle of water, and that's it. That's the change.
They just wanted me to click on the story to get that, as you put it, clickbait, because that's not a change.
Right. They wanted us all to panic and go, oh, God, they promised us that they wouldn't change the price.
Right. Not the hot dog. Not the Costco hot dog. The one thing left in our world we can depend on.
Is nothing sacred.
Nothing. Well, anyway, so now you can have water.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the fountain drink's a better deal anyway. It's bigger than the bottle of water.
I'm glad that you figured that out very quickly for us. Well done.
Thank you. The team.
Mike Parsons, Danielle Mason, Rich Luzinski. I'm Paul W. Smith, and we're happy to be with you in Focus with Relentless Positive Radio right here on WJR. Well, I know we've had a lot of attention on a lot of other stories, but the Iran situation is ongoing and still creates a problem. President Trump and his national security team remain doubtful about Iran's recent proposal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz while delaying discussions on its nuclear program, which we've all been led to believe a complete halt to nuclear enrichment and a firm pledge never to develop nuclear weapons is all they're really looking for. Let's talk to a guy in the know, former Navy intelligence officer Austin Gullett, who joins us here, Paul W. Smith in Focus. Austin, nice meeting you.
Yeah, very good to meet you and good to be here, Paul.
What are your thoughts about all of this?
Well, I think Iran is being run by hardliners. I think it's probably the most degree of hardliners run the country that we've seen since the 1979 revolution that installed the supreme religious leader. And so I think the folks making the decisions, it's a mix of the IRGC, the Supreme National Security Council, and then other hardline security figures. And they're driving Iran's war strategy, diplomacy. And I think mostly the IRGC seems to be in control of the decisions, more that military body, unless, you know, of their typical diplomats like the president and their foreign ministers. The supreme religious leader's son, you know, was seriously wounded, and he hasn't appeared in public since taking power. And so everything I'm seeing is that access to him is extremely limited due to fear of strikes from the U.S. and Israel. So because of that, Iran is slow to respond to negotiations based on, you know, handwritten notes and a dynamic courier system that they use to relay information to the new supreme religious leader. And according to a Pakistani negotiator, you know, there doesn't appear to be one clean decision-making command and structure in Iran, and it usually takes Iran 2 to 3 days to respond. So I found that, you know, quite interesting.
Austin Gullett joining us, former Navy intelligence officer, and he's right. I mean, what else do we need to see, hear, or experience to convince ourselves that it is the hardliners still in charge? And the hardliners have made it extremely clear that they aren't taking nuclear enrichment and a pledge to not develop nuclear weapons off the table. They're keeping it. They're not, I mean, it's for them, it's off the table. For us, it's not off the table. So it's a real standoff. We say that they can't have this, and they say they won't go without this. And if they had said we need nuclear energy for our power and other stuff, that'd be one thing. But they're not ruling out the nuclear weapons, and we aren't going to let that stand. So what the heck? Are we just going back to bombing?
Yeah, I think so. And yes, when you enrich uranium to 60%, you're certainly not concerned with providing power to your country. Yeah, from the Iranian perspective, you know, they closed the Strait of Hormuz a little over 3 weeks ago. And out of that, you know, the war stopped and we went into negotiations with them. And after 3 weeks of those negotiations, it certainly doesn't appear Iran will ever meet President Trump's demands and have an acceptable deal. So I think Iran's play is they want to drag out negotiations to allow for more political and economic pressure on the president until he stops the war. But, you know, we're not going to do that. Our blockade has been very effective and is keeping, you know, more than 80% of Iran's revenue, you know, is being denied. And that is not sustainable for Iran.
Austin, as a former Navy intelligence officer, what does your gut and your experience tell you regarding for these periods of time when the president steps up and says, you know, I'm not sure who we're dealing with. I'm not sure who we're supposed to be dealing with. I'm not sure who's really running the show. All of those things. Do you think that's all done on purpose by Iran?
I don't know if it's that orchestrated, because I think our military strikes and all the very specific kinetic strikes on the leadership has really deteriorated that regime to a place to where it probably is in disarray. And, you know, we mentioned the handwritten notes and the courier systems out of continued strike, fear of strikes. And so I think the chaos is real. I think we lean into our intelligence services heavily to really understand the on-the-ground atmospherics a little bit better. But I think going forward, you know, Trump's got to step up the military operations again. I think we have to continue the blockade and then recognize we're not going to get a negotiated settlement with these hardliners. I think we return to combat operations, finish about 25% of the military objectives that we had remaining, and then you open the Straits of Hormuz and we see how Iran responds.
Quick question on another topic, OPEC, we talked about earlier. Of course, the group of the world's largest, biggest oil exporters that coordinate output in order to influence global supply and prices. It's legalized price fixing. Now, the move will allow the UAE, one of OPEC's top three producers, to break free from the output limits imposed by the cartel, whose de facto leader is Saudi Arabia. Are the implications here for the global oil market that maybe this whole thing could further disintegrate this group, and what would that lead to?
Yeah, is this the first break in the dam? No, I agree. I mean, you know, UAE, they're ending a nearly six-decade membership in OPEC, and UAE's been growing increasingly frustrated with OPEC's production quotas. You know, and UAE's arguing they've been forced to hold back while investing heavily in their capacity. So I think short term, there's no significant impacts to the market, but long term, more UAE oil produced means lowered prices for the market and lessened OPEC control and sort of a lessening of that OPEC cartel. And hopefully it's, you know, maybe other countries follow suit. And it's more of a free market.
Hey, it's our first time talking, I believe. Give us a little thumbnail biography of yourself.
Sure. No, you're kind, Paul. I live in Tampa with a wife and two kids. I'm a retired naval officer, went to the Naval Academy, and then did 20 years active on ships and then intelligence and with Naval Special Warfare. I was a diplomat in Eastern Europe for 4 years. And now I still, you know, and involved and care about things like this and like to talk to folks like yourself. And WJR has been great. And, I've got a cleaning company here and I do some other defense stuff and, you know, still have a little bit of me to serve or contribute in some way.
Well, we appreciate and embrace your expertise and your experience. And we're proud to have you on the air with us and to help our WJR listeners get insight they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. Thank you, Austin. We'll talk again.
Thank you for the kind candor, Paul. Great to meet you.
Austin Gellett, former Navy intelligence officer. You've heard him on WJR elsewhere. Our first time to have a chance to speak with him. In Focus with Paul W. Smith at WJR, approaching 129. Our next guest, Richard Zuba, founder of the Glengariff Group, has been around calling balls and strikes for a very long time in the political world, and he continues, and he does a great job. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Richard. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
So far, what we are hearing, what we know, but you can throw some fat on all of this, is that United States Representative John James has maintained an early lead in the race to be the Republican nominee for governor. There has been a surge in spending by businessman Perry Johnson. This all according to a new poll of likely Michigan GOP primary voters that was released yesterday. It kind of a phone survey. What can you tell us about it? I guess it was commissioned by the Detroit Regional Chamber, which had come out endorsing Mike Duggan and his bid for governor.
Yeah, the chamber sponsored this survey, and they did so simply to set the stage for Mackinac Conference. So so people understand where the what the races look like. And at this stage, we have John James leading Perry Johnson 37-20, Mike Cox at 10, and Eric Nesbitt at 7. And I think it's important, you mentioned that we've had this influx of spending by Perry Johnson. This has all been within 2 months that he has surged 20%. Now, these voters like John James, but this race is, I think, far from over. We've got 3 more months. And the question is, can Perry Johnson move from being in the conversation to being close to dead even with John James? And that's a big question.
Richard, who benefited most, if there is one person, from former State House Speaker Tom Leonard dropping out?
Well, they included him in this survey. He hadn't dropped out yet. When we did it, he got about 2.5%. It wasn't very large. You know, there's about 17-18% still undecided in this race. One of the interesting things we see is that John James has a what we call a favorable unfavorable of 55-14, meaning 55% of voters view him favorably, 14 unfavorable. For Perry Johnson, that's 31-19. So one of the challenges all the other candidates face against John James is he is still very popular. And as we all know, in campaigns, we're going to undoubtedly see the negatives start. And that's going to have to happen if they want to bring John James down some.
And at this point, that's all they can hope to do, I guess, is go after the leader. That's a fascinating favorable, unfavorable, 55 favorable, 14 unfavorable. When was the last time we had a politician in that kind of a position, Richard?
Actually, because these are just primary voters, Republican primary voters, those are good numbers. They're fairly standard for a front runner, to be honest. What I think we have to expect, though, is that's going to shift as people really focus in on this race. As I said, 3 months away, we've just really started the race for all practical purposes.
Fascinating. All right. The new poll shows Haley Stevens with a slim U.S. Senate lead. What do you know about that, Richard Zuba?
Yeah, I got to tell you, this Democratic Senate nomination is a fascinating race. We have Haley Stevens at 25, Abdul El-Sayed at 23, and Mallory McMorrow at 16. But the leader at 36% is undecided. And so this is a wide open race. And what's really interesting is we're walking into May 1st, and none of these campaigns has gone up on the air yet. And come the end of June, about half of the Democratic voters will have a ballot in their hand with absentee ballots. So we're really looking at a very condensed race over 2 months to build name ID. And there's some really fascinating differences occurring in this race. With Haley Stevens doing extraordinarily well in Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb, black voters over 65. Abdul El-Sayed's doing very well with college voters, white voters, and voters outside of the metro area, and Democratic socialists. So we've got very interesting lanes shaping up in this race.
I sure do. And we're lucky to have a guy who's been doing this for years, and that would be you, Richard Zuba, the founder of the Glengariff Group. And these are the people to listen to and to watch, and we will continue to do that. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You do the same. We continue in Focus with Paul W. Smith at about 1:43 on WJR. Well, this next segment is partially being done to make sure that my next guest's head can still fit in the door to come in the studio, because he just experienced a larger-than-life, once-in-a-lifetime experience by being there with King Charles in a rare speech to a joint meeting of the U.S. Senate and U.S. House of Representatives. He was a part of the prolonged standing ovation at the entrance of King Charles and Queen Camilla. This has not happened since the king's mother was there speaking to both houses in 1991. And from everything we could tell watching on television, it went brilliantly well. But now let's talk to Ryan Ermani, who was there in person. How incredible was it, Ryan?
Beyond any words that I can ever describe, Paul. And, you know, quite the opposite experience for me. It has made me feel so much smaller than anything I've ever experienced. Truly humbling to get the invitation to walk those halls, to be in that chamber. And again, the king and his speech, his address to the joint session, that was the cherry on top. For me, if you are a lover of history of this country, if you follow government, if you're interested into seeing how it works, to be in that chamber, the history and everything surrounding it, it was truly the moment of a lifetime, the experience of a lifetime. I've covered World Series, Stanley Cup Final. I was in the locker room with the Red Wings when they won the Cup in 08. I've covered a Super Bowl, Final Four. That moment to me yesterday was up there, if not surpassed anything I've ever done in this business.
I would think so. I mean, it was, and always will be historic. And though the people said the Queen was beloved and handled all of this very well, I'm going to tell you that I think Charles III did as good a job or better in his own style because he's looser and he's funnier than the Queen ever felt she should be.
Paul, he was hilarious. I mean, there was like 6 to 8 jokes that he lobbed off kind of and got everybody in the chamber going. And what I really loved about the speech was I thought it was pretty uniting. And I loved that there was not one moment, not even one, that only one side or the other stood. I believe he got 12 standing ovations, and all 12 of them came from the entire chamber. And I thought that was very respectful and very accurate as to what he was saying.
That in itself is historic, and I don't remember the last time that happened. Maybe it was in 1991 when the Queen was there, but you're right. Everybody embraced him and the Queen, and he said he came here today with the highest respect for the United States Congress, this citadel of democracy created to represent the voice of all American people to advance sacred rights and freedoms. He said all of this with such an easy charm, and you knew he was speaking from the heart. He was not just reading a speech. He embraced the gravity as well. And it was just fabulous. I'm so glad you were able to be there. God bless Congressman Tim Walberg for making the offer in the first place and thinking of WJR in the first place to have us there and you representing us here. Did you see a lot of people you knew?
Name the person, and I saw him. The only person I did not see yesterday, and I didn't anticipate to see him, was the president himself.
Right, he made it clear he was not going.
Exactly. Everybody else, I mean, from Chuck Schumer to Hakeem Jeffries to Tim Burchett to Ted Cruz. I mean, Nancy
Debbie
Pelosi,
Dingell.
Debbie Dingell.
Debbie, I thought for sure she'd move closer to the aisle and say, hey, good to see you again, or something. But
Debbie Dingell, Congresswoman Dingell, it was a great moment. You know, sitting up there in the balcony, and Congressman Walberg grabbed Congresswoman Dingell and pointed up to me in the audience in the gallery, and she waved and was so happy for me. And I just, our Michigan congregation, delegation, I should say, our Michigan delegation is just remarkable people, and they really want to do right by the people of Michigan, and it's spectacular to see.
Absolutely, and you put on, Mike Parsons earlier showed us on your Facebook page, you have a picture
yes.
and a finger pointing at where you are in the the upper gallery, if you will, the upper deck, so that people can actually see where you were and how much you were enjoying it. And we talked with the congressman earlier, and he talked about your enthusiasm. I said, like, and I think he said this too, is it like a kid in a candy shop? And, you know,
beyond that, even
a friend named Clark Durant, Cornerstone Schools, was there. He tried to talk me into going, and I could not.
I was on the plane, same plane as him.
Well, then, you know what, Clark, the beauty of Clark is yesterday, today, he's at the fabulous Country Club of Detroit doing a presentation on Winston Churchill, of which he is pretty famous about. So this ties in so beautifully with what he was doing. It's just an amazing circumstance and situation. I'm glad you were able to go and to enjoy it, and you got home. I sent you a note last night. You got home safe and sound to your family, who probably couldn't wait to hear all about it, and I'm sure your listeners can't wait to hear all about it in just minutes. So
absolutely.
Congratulations to you.
Paul, thank you for all your support, too, as well. I mean, you've been incredible, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, I'm just glad you were able to go and enjoy yourself, and I can't wait to hear all about it coming up in minutes. Stand by for news. And then it's JR Afternoon with Ryan Ermani, with lots to talk about his experience, a once-in-a-lifetime experience with King Charles III and Congress, the Senate, the whole House of Representatives, the whole shebang. And he's got inside insight because he was there. Meanwhile, go on out, make it a great rest of the day, and we'll look forward to being with you tomorrow on location with the Detroit Economic Club. Regards, Paul W. Smith.